Coming up on Tech News Weekly, Micah Sargent and I talk about some pretty important news this week, an unprecedented Twitter hack that led to big questions about the platform. We dive into that with Steve Gibson. Also, Apple News has a bunch of new audio content, local news. We talk about that. Also, a look into the EFF's Atlas of Surveillance. And finally, we round things out by chatting about Twitter's new API changes for developers and how librarians are bringing escape rooms to Google Forms. A little weird, but we talk about that next on Tech News Weekly. Tech News Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. You're focused on security, but are your employees? LastPass can ensure that they are by making access and authentication seamless, whether they're working in the office or remote. Visit LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 142, recorded Thursday, July 16th, 2020.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Casper. Casper is a sleep brand that makes expertly designed products to help you get your best rest one night at a time. Get $100 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/twit1 and using promo code TWIT1 at checkout.
And by IT Pro TV. Get the most up-to-date IT professional training with IT Pro TV. Visit itpro.tv/TNW for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription. Use code TNW30 at checkout.
And by ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is an app that reroutes your internet connection through their secure servers so your ISP can't see the sites you visit. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/TNW. Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Micah Sargent.
And I'm Jason Howell. I tried to like mouth that intro while you were saying it, but I realized like with Skype lag, it doesn't matter how on time I am. It's on time for me, but no one else.
Right. In fact, that's Leo and I, whenever we do iOS, we used to say today together, but I say today and then he says today and it's never in sync. Okay.
Yes, exactly. Never in sync. 2020 in a nutshell. Let's do this. This is a big, big story. Twitter experienced its worst hijacking to date. A number of incredibly high-profile accounts, if you were on yesterday, you saw that they began tweeting out details to some sort of a Bitcoin thing. It's a scam, of course. Accounts belonging to Elon Musk, Bill Gates, Joe Biden, Apple. I mean, so many, not to mention a number of cryptocurrency sites themselves have accounts, and those were tweeting out this scam. Kind of crazy. They were all involved in this coordinated attack, coordinated hack. I don't know what you want to call it. Joining us to talk about what happened and what the clues all seem to be pointing toward is Steve Gibson from GRC.com and, of course, host of Security Now for Twit. Welcome, Steve.
Hey, guys. Great to be with you this morning.
Yeah, and what a juicy story we have to talk about right here. This, I have to imagine, when things like this happen, your ears like perk up and you're like, all right, I'm on the case.
Like, this is like disturbance in the force. Did you have that moment of like, oh, something's happened?
Well, you know, what was interesting about this was that it was so big. I mean, it was like so many different high profile accounts that it immediately seemed like an inside job. You couldn't imagine that many high-profile individuals could have had their accounts hacked separately. And one of the Winklevi indicated that one of theirs was protected by two-factor authentication. So, you know, that we know that at least in some instances there was extra protection from the, you know, like that would protect against a brute force hack. And Twitter, after a couple hours of saying, oh, crap, what happened here? They tweeted, we detected what we believe to be a coordinated social engineering attack by people who successfully targeted some of our employees with access to internal systems and tools. We know they used this access to take control of many highly visible, including verified, accounts and tweet on their behalf. We're looking into what other malicious activity may have been conducted or information they have accessed, and we'll share what we have here as we know it. And what was interesting was when, you know, shortly after this, you guys invited me to join you today. And so I attempted to tweet the fact that I would be on the show to my followers, and I was blocked. I got this pop-up that said, "This looks like suspicious activity. We don't believe you're not a bot." And I said, "What?" And so I tried to rephrase what I tweeted. Well, then, of course, later it turned out that Twitter's reaction to this was to block all verified users, blanket across the board, feeling like, you know, it was only high-profile verified users who were being targeted. So let's just keep any verified users from tweeting anything at all. And so that lasted until the evening for, you know, a few hours, and then I was able to make the announcement. But what appears to have happened is, Motherboard and Vice tweeted some screenshots which have appeared. Various people have been putting them into their Twitter feeds, and those are immediately deleted and their feeds are blocked because Twitter is very sensitive to this. But they appear to show the use of an internal tool. And of course, Twitter has to have internal management tools in order to control things. And so, and in Vice's coverage, they say that their underground sources have indicated that a Twitter employee was bought off, was actually paid money in order to do something, to turn over access or to manually do this. But, and so, you know, details are still fuzzy, but that's the way something this big happened, was that, you know, Twitter inside has the technology to do anything they want. And so that, of course, breaks all of the protections from someone hacking in from the outside if you just get somebody on the inside.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting when all of this was first starting to happen. All of the people going to Twitter to say, "I can't believe these high-profile people didn't have two-factor authentication activated." Of course, not realizing perhaps when they tweeted this out, just the scale of this, probably, and the level of these people, the level that they operate at, means that of course they have two-factor authentication. They've probably done, and they probably have advisors that that have them, you know, locking down their accounts, or at least we hope, as strongly as you possibly could as a mere user of someone else's service. This just wasn't that type of attack. This was, like you said, some sort of socially engineered thing, which is really hard to protect against. Isn't this kind of like the hardest thing for people to protect against? Because anybody can be convinced.
And in fact, I remember on Security Now when Leo and I years ago were talking about that big Sony hack, where we later found out that a so-called APT, an advanced persistent threat, had been installed into Sony Entertainment's network quite a while before it came to light. And I said on the podcast that, you know, the worst possible job I could imagine would be responsible for protecting something like the size of Sony from any sort of exploit. Because, you know, I mean, that's what phishing is. You know, phishing mail is tricking an assistant to someone, thinking that it's you're someone legitimate, and, you know, tricking them into giving away some information that then allows that to be leveraged. So it's the human factor that is now pretty much the easiest way of getting in, because we've got so much technology, as you were saying, with multi-factor authentication and authenticators and, you know, and all kinds of technical solutions, but still people inside Twitter are inside Twitter.
So one question I have about this aspect of it, this console that exists, you know, part of it kind of reminds me of a couple of years ago, the Uber God mode thing that was quite a kerfuffle when that happened. Like in that case, and then also in this case, if I look at it logically, I can say, okay, as a service, you know, with many different aspects, something like of course a tool like this or some sort of access like this exists.
Maybe the wagging of the finger isn't that a tool like this exists, but rather it's not being controlled properly. In other words, employees at Twitter obviously have access to a tool that gives them direct access into verified and in some cases the leaders of the world into their direct communications and possibly their DMs and everything. How can they do this differently? How should they do this differently so that they can have both sides, or does it even need to exist at all?
So I love what you were saying, because you were saying, an employee has access. We should use the past tense at this point.
Good point.
Because I don't think this is going to happen again. In really highly secure environments, we do have technology that uses a sort of a majority voting approach. You wouldn't want to lock a tool like this, where when you have to use it, you have to be able to use it. You wouldn't want to require like all four of some selected people to have to be able to all agree. But you could, that we have the technology in cryptography of, for example, giving 9 people the ability, and you need any 4 of those 9 to be in order to enable something like this. So I'll be very surprised if Twitter doesn't do something like that, if they don't re-engineer this so that no 1 or 2 or even 3 people simultaneously compromised can compromise the technology. It'll take, some sort of a subset of a committee to all agree to do that. So you can both be sure that you're able to do it, that you're able to use the tool when you need to, and it cannot be abused in the way this happened this time. And that technology exists. They just didn't have it in place, apparently.
Yeah. Wow. And so now behind the scenes, of course, like I just saw news, FBI has opened an investigation. Senator Ron Wyden is weighing in. Ron Wyden, of course, weighs in a lot on kind of the social media aspects of technology. Yeah, technology in general.
Everybody's going to pile on now, unfortunately. But, it's Twitter has now become the news conduit, for better or often for worse. But that's what we have. And with great power comes great responsibility. So they're going to take some heat for this. They're apologizing, and Jack Dorsey's been on Twitter saying, "Oh my goodness," he said, "a tough day for us at Twitter." He said, "We all feel terrible this happened. We're diagnosing and we'll share everything we can when we have a more complete understanding of exactly what happened." He says, now, that'll be interesting. I hope we really do, because people are going to want to know. And so ultimately, I guess, especially with all of the as important as this is, I have a feeling we'll end up with a complete understanding of it eventually.
I mean,
it's worth mentioning that the bad guys got the highest number I've seen was $300,000. I saw 120 earlier, but the actual hack was asking people to send money to a Bitcoin address and you'd get twice your money back. Well, I don't think that second part is going to happen for anyone, but $300,000 by some reports were transferred into the Bitcoin address that the hackers published in these hacked tweets.
I mean, and no matter what, with this sort of scam, it's all a numbers game, right? Like, it's easy to look at this and be like, why would anyone ever do that? Well, people do, because it's all numbers, right? You cast that net far and wide enough, and you're going to find the few, the very small percentage of people that are like, oh, yeah, okay, I'll do that. That makes sense to me. And sure enough, they make money as a result.
I saw a car in the street the other day that was the worst color I could imagine, but somebody bought it. So, yeah,
another way to put it. finally, what do you think a hack of this magnitude, or I don't know, I guess you probably can't call this a hack necessarily, social engineering attack, whatever you want to call it. What do you think this does for a company like Twitter? I know their stock price is kind of dropping a little bit. Not to mention, important to note, President Trump is is and uses Twitter very heavily. So one could argue that this could have gone a completely different direction. Somebody could have, you know, gotten access and tweeted out something that would incite violence or a war. Who the heck knows? Use your imagination. What do you see this doing for a company like Twitter going forward?
I think for all of us, this is a sort of a cautionary note about the fact that we have created really socially powerful technology. I mean, earth-shaking technology. I did see some reporting that said that the set of people who were hacked did not seem to be fans of our president. I don't know if that was relevant in any way. I did also see that our president's Twitter account was not blocked the way mine was and all other verified users were. Certainly Donald Trump's account is verified. So they probably thought, okay, we're going to, you know, they probably put somebody on vetting that on the fly so that the president could continue tweeting in real time as he likes to do, while everybody who was, you know, going to be able to get less scrutiny was just blocked because that was the easiest thing to do. But I think overall, this really does say that, as I said, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. Facebook has great power. Twitter has great power. It's clear that this demonstrates they weren't taking that serious. Twitter wasn't taking their power as seriously as they should. So this is a mistake. They will doubtless fix it and arrange to make it far more difficult for this kind of thing to happen in the future. Ultimately, though, I mean, there are servers, it's technology that, you know, there could be a compromise of their technology, not of their people, which could still do this. So the other takeaway for, I think, all of us is, let's keep our skepticism level up to some point, because it is, after all, just technology, and technology can fail.
Indeed. And, if you're around technology long enough, it will. It's just a matter of time. Yes. It's just the way it works. Steve Gibson, always love getting you on the show. Always love being on Security Now when I have the opportunity. So it's great to bring you on to our show for a change. GRC.com. And definitely everybody make sure to check out, you probably already are, but Security Now on the Twit Network, twit.tv/SN. Steve, thank you so much. I'm sure you're going to talk about this next week on the show.
My pleasure, guys.
Right on. Take care, man. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Up next, Apple has expanded on its news offerings, including new audio features like a briefing from Apple News editors. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the cost. The original Casper mattress is the one that I use and the one that I very much enjoy. Casper's whole suite of products are cleverly designed to mimic human curves, providing supportive comfort for all kinds of bodies. And look, you spend one third of your life sleeping, so you should be comfortable while you're doing it. That original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amount of both sink and bounce. Plus, its breathable design helps you sleep cool and regulates your body temperature throughout the night. And with over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars across Casper, Amazon, and Google, Casper is quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. Casper also offers some other mattresses. There's the Wave, the Essential, and the Hybrid. The Wave features a patent-pending premium support system to mirror the natural shape of your body. The Essential has a streamlined design at a price that's not going to keep you up at night. And the Hybrid combines the pressure relief of the award-winning foam with durable yet gentle springs. I remember getting my Casper, dragging the box upstairs and putting it into my master bedroom, opening up that box and cutting away the plastic and watching my mattress take its first breath. And then I got to lay down on it and make that same exact sound because it was so comfortable. That mattress has been with me from all over the state of Missouri. Now it's with me here in California. I love my Casper mattress, my Casper sheets, my Casper pillow. See, yeah, we all love Casper here at Twit.
Love them.
It's fantastic. So there is that concern that you get a mattress and you don't want it. I don't think that's going to happen with Casper, but just in case, you should know that you can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. Plus, Casper offers free shipping and painless returns to the U.S. and Canada. You can get a Casper mattress today and save $100 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/twit1. That's important. Use code TWIT1 at checkout. That's $100 off select mattresses by going to casper.com/twit1 and entering the code TWIT1 at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. Our thanks to Casper for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. So I heard, for a while now, there were some rumors that Apple was going to be launching a new feature to go along with Apple News. So Apple News was the app that lets you subscribe to magazines. It lets you see, it almost served as a bit of an RSS feed reader, but with perfectly chosen content for you, curated content, and it gave you all the information that you needed to know. There was a rumor going around, though, that Apple was going to be adding an audio feature to Apple News. And with that came the question of exactly how they were going to go about doing that, what it meant to have an Apple News Plus audio section. Well, they have officially launched this feature as well as some new local news offerings. And I am pleased to have Renee Ritchie of youtube.com/Renee Ritchie, as well as MacBreak Weekly host here on the Twit Network. Renee Ritchie, hello and welcome.
Hey, Micah Sargent, how you doing?
I'm doing peachy keen, thank you. Good to have you here.
And Jason.
thank you. So let's break right into it. Can you give us kind of an you know, we talked a little bit about this before the show. Renee is one of those incredible Canadians. And with the Canadian part of it comes the fact that sometimes Apple will release stuff in some countries that isn't available in others. But I was hoping that you could give us a little bit of an overview kind of what this announcement is bringing forth. Kind of what are the headline features or new things that we can look for with this Apple News update?
Yeah, for sure. So I'll preface it just briefly by saying that when you look at Music Plus or you look at TV Plus, these are services that Apple rolled out to 100, now maybe 150 countries with the snap of a finger, where News Plus has been in like less 4 or 5 countries going on 4 or 5 years now. And that should tell you everything you need to know about how much more difficult the licensing is for this kind of content than it is for music or television. And I think that's part of what makes this so interesting. They are partnering because with News Plus, it's often the language they use is partnering, I think, because established news media feels sort of under siege by the tyranny of the Google and Facebook algorithms, you know, just stripping all their content away from them. So Apple's partnering with them to produce audio shows, essentially analogous to podcasts. In fact, one of them is a podcast where the Apple News host will do an overview of their carefully curated news content for the day, what they consider to be the most interesting and important stories, but they're also teaming with those publications, you know, things like Vanity Fair, to produce audio versions of some of the biggest feature stories of the week. I think they said they're going to do 20 of those a week now, and they're professionally narrated, almost like you're someone with like a Micah Sargent or Leo Laporte style big time radio voice going through and very carefully enunciating all the syllables to make it sound like a really awesome presentation. And that's that part of it, the part with just the 20 feature stories, is U.S. only. But other elements of it, the podcast specifically, seems to be available in other places and even different podcast apps if you want to search for it.
Yeah, so let's talk about the podcast first before we get into the audio that's within the app. And the reason why is because of what you've just said. You know, there was some concern when this feature was still in the rumored stage. You know, it's weird how rumors often lead to fear, uncertainty, and doubt, huh? Anyway, let's talk about how. You know, at once it was maybe thought that this was going to be a sort of walled off approach, that this podcast would exist in a place where others couldn't get access to it. And it was Apple's first foray into sort of
going
the route
Joe
of Spotify.
Rogan.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So what is this podcast exactly? And then it is then an RSS feed that people can go and subscribe to in whatever podcast app.
Yeah, and I get the feeling because there are some people who have a very deep emotional connection with podcasts going back to the days of RSS and the free internet. And, you know, we're all a little bit of that beatnik hippie inside of us if we've grown up, in the post-Dave Wiener era of the internet. And Spotify has given people some concern that podcasts will be closed down and made to be featured content the way some Netflix content is or Apple TV Plus content is. But Apple seems to be doing this just like a podcast. And I think there's also some disagreement about whether podcasts are special, precious things, or they're just another form of audio content, like an audiobook or like music. So we're not quite sure how we feel about all this stuff yet, but we are very reassured that this is still a podcast. We don't have to think about it too much yet.
That's good. Yeah.
The bigger questions, at least.
A podcast that is it a daily podcast? Because that was the part that I didn't quite pick up on.
It's a weekly podcast, I believe. I believe it's a weekly podcast.
Yeah, so we'll hear sort of a summary of the week's most important news, or at least news stories that the Apple News curators want to cover.
And they want to put a huge emphasis on the journalism. You hear that word over and over again when they talk about it. And I think that goes back to Steve Jobs, where for a brief moment in time, he thought the iPad could rescue journalism. But they want to not just go over the news, because I think there's a lot, especially in the modern era, where we don't respect our sources, we don't reference them, you know, and the where the information comes from gets very quickly forgotten. And they want to not just promote the stories, but the journalism and the outlets that went into those stories.
Gotcha. Yeah. So then let's talk about Apple News Plus audio stories. Yes, that is a long word or a long phrase. But this is interesting to me because shortly before this had all been announced, the New York Times was sort of taking a step back from Apple News Plus and was sort of going its own way. And with that, I saw a tweet, I think it was from Farhad Manjoo, who had posted an article on the New York Times, or posted, you know, a piece on the New York Times, and had narrated it as well, had included an audio version. Now, that is one way of doing things. This way, it's my understanding that Apple has, like you said, hired professional voice actors to do this. Yeah. So I'm just curious about your take on this. Do you, as a person who for a long time, you know, wrote stories and continues to write articles and things like that, do you feel there's a disconnect when you have a voice actor or voice performer doing reading the stories that someone else has written? Or do you feel like this could work?
So, and that's a good point. I originally got my idea from Joanna Stern, because she would make an article and a video in the Wall Street Journal, and you could choose which one you wanted. They weren't perfect duplicates, but they were, you could choose where the content was. And when I started my YouTube channel, I very specifically wanted to have the video and the audio and the text available so that you could choose the medium. To me, it was an accessibility thing. I didn't even think about it in terms of performance or art or medium. It was just, I want to make everything accessible to everybody. And when I first heard Apple announce this, I wondered if there was an accessibility angle where they didn't just want to give you a screen reader, but they wanted to give you like a performance of some of the best pieces. And I still wonder if that's part of the inspiration. But I think at the end, it's going to have to be an incredibly tight line that they walk, because when the author reads it, it's just the author reading their own words. But if someone is narrating it, there's a very quick line between awesome and cringe that you don't want to pass.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. And I guess I hadn't considered the way that this is almost reminiscent of not just captions on a you know, movie or something like that, but actual audio descriptions.
Yeah,
where I've turned those on before simply to have the experience and understand how that works. And yeah, it's a whole nother kind of experience. And I think what I find interesting, and you know, this line that I think is going to have to be towed here is, what kinds of pieces end up getting. It looks like Apple says it's going to be about 20 audio stories a week across a wide range of interests. And I think about the editorialization that can take place in the delivery of written word when it's spoken. And that is one of the concerns that I have, because the way you say and can change the utter meaning of a piece. And so that's going to be fascinating. And I don't know, do we have any more knowledge, any knowledge past this newsroom announcement about if the voice actors are going to be working closely with the authors of the piece? Like, is there anything we know about the process by which Apple selects these stories and then does produce them?
I don't think we know the exact process for this. I think just extrapolating from what we know of Apple, it will be something that they practiced 100 times, 1,000 times internally. And hopefully, like, very early on, they caught the things like, and so the cabbage was removed from the shelves until the blight infestation, like sort of like when Andy Nocco gets into his opera voice. You know, that part they probably pushed down on very quickly. But I'm guessing there'll also be some trial and error, and they'll get feedback in the first week about whether they're hitting the target or not.
Definitely. I'm definitely looking forward to checking that part out. And then the last thing was curated local news. Yeah. So I think this is really interesting. There are different apps and different news services that provide curated local news in different ways. But this is to give people the ability to see what's going on in their, you know, locale. What are the areas that are being covered right now? Is it a lot of them, or is it, you know, very few? What are we looking at there with curated local news?
So it's I want to say it's a little bit of both, but it's not really. It's like a Bay Area, which is like the San Francisco Bay Area, Houston, Los Angeles, New York, and San Francisco. But they're also adding more local newspapers. Like, they're going to add Le Devoir, which is a very well-known French language newspaper in Quebec. So it depends on the size of your locality. In the U.S., there's a lot of you guys have so many big cities, Micah, that the rest of us don't really
have
to deal with. But that's really important, because a lot of papers have run out of funding, and they often just run news that comes in off the wire, and it's hard to invest in local reporting, and the resources aren't there. And I don't know if this will give them a boost or not, but I think it's important when you go to your phone that you don't just get the big stories from around the country, because you forget what's happening at home.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of so I went to journalism school, and one of the sort of recommendations that was made at that time was not to forget that local news is taking place as well, and to always be aware of that. And so to have this as an option, I think, is great. And, you know, I look to the New York Times has had some failures. Especially recently, but I look to the New York Times as overall an entity that is a has journalistic integrity. And with that, you know, I think about, I just signed up to have the paper version of the New York Times, and there was an option to get a daily briefing of local news for myself in my area specifically. And I remember looking at that and remembering that recommendation that was made to me in J school. And it was just kind of a nice moment. And so to see this coming to Apple News as well, as a person who does use the Apple News app regularly, I think this is great. Apple News has been an excellent tool for me in terms of keeping my family updated and in the know about the COVID-19 crisis and things like that. So it's
been getting better. Like, hopefully now, the biggest problem before was if you saw an article on the web that you couldn't that you knew you'd get for free in Apple News, there was no way to actually move over to Apple News and find it. And it looks like they're addressing things like that in iOS 14. So it's getting there.
Cool. Well, Renee Ritchie, I want to thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to join us. If folks want to follow you online and check out your great work, where do they go to do that?
I'm at Renee Ritchie on Twitter and youtube.com/Renee Ritchie. And of course, here every Tuesday with all you fine folks on MacBreak Weekly.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Micah. Thanks, Jason.
All right. So up next, taking surveillance that's all around the country and putting it on an interactive map. We're going to talk a little bit about this project by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro TV. This is all about educating yourself for the IT world. Do you know how long well-qualified tech job candidates are on the job market? Well, 10 days. It's not hiring. It's more like a bidding war, especially right now. Things are crazy. IT Pro TV is an engaging and effective online IT professional training platform. They're going to help guide you into the IT career of your dreams with all the support that you need to be successful. So you can take courses for networking skills or security skills, Linux, Apple, and so much more. And you can earn certificates in A+, CCNP, and so many more, including CompTIA. IT Pro TV is also the official video training partner for CompTIA and has 12 CompTIA on-demand courses. With over 5,800 hours of IT training, IT Pro TV is the best place to go for getting started or continuing in your IT career. And you can sign up for a premium membership to let an expert guide you with setting goals and implementing an IT training program to help you reach those goals ultimately. IT Pro TV also has a learning coach for teams, so you can engage and grow the skill base of your team members through a corporate premium membership. Go to IT Pro TV and start to explore different career paths, job resources, virtual labs, practice tests, all of that, so you can see for yourself the amazing opportunities that you have to learn from the best professionals in the industry. And if you want to learn a little more, go to IT Pro TV and catch their podcast. It's called Technado with Don Pezzett. It features industry guests and IT news recaps. In July, happens to be IT Pro TV's CompTIA month. They're going to have CompTIA-themed webinars, a free CompTIA training weekend, a CompTIA-themed game show, CompTIA guests on their podcast, and so much more. It's CompTIA crazy over there, so go check it out. Go to IT Pro TV and join a community of IT pros who are sharpening their skills the fun way. Go to itpro.tv/TNW and use code TNW30. You'll receive 30% off all consumer subscriptions. That's itpro.tv/TNW and use code TNW30 for an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV, build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. And we thank them for their support. So surveillance, we talk about it on the show a lot. In the U.S., it's in the midst of its biggest moment yet, I would say. Emerging technology is paving the way for unprecedented tracking and data analysis associated with that tracking. Any of these technologies are so new that there really hasn't been an adequate thought put into whether they're being used responsibly, what long-term ramifications are in all of these cases, so many things to think of. There's a new project called the Atlas of Surveillance. It attempts to capture the breadth of all this tracking, and it's the result of a collaboration between the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who we love on the show, and the University of Nevada's Reynolds School of Journalism. Dave Mass is senior investigative researcher at EFF, and you helped lead the project. And you're joining us now. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Hey, thanks for having me, as well as my neighbor and their construction.
Well, good. I have construction going on in our garage as well, so I feel that pain. It's all good. Yeah. We will work.
Everybody's if you want me to have some video of me hitting the ceiling, we can do that too. But I'd rather talk about surveillance.
All right, let's talk about surveillance instead. That's a whole lot more fun. Not really. Not the concept of surveillance necessarily, but this project that you guys are putting together is pretty awesome. How did this come to be? And kind of give us a quick little walkthrough as far as what it is and how it came to be.
Sure. So at EFF, I get phone calls all the time from activism groups, from journalists, from researchers, academics, lawyers. And generally, there are two types of questions I get over and over again. And the first is, how is one surveillance technology, say face recognition or license plate readers or drones, who has that across the country? How is that technology spreading across the country? The second question we get is from somebody on the local level. I live in Minneapolis, or I live in St. Louis, or I live in Tulsa. What technology do my local police have? And you know, usually I spend some time researching and I'm able to help them find those answers. But then it's like, why isn't there a central hub that has all of this information? And the reason there isn't this hub is because there's a ton of work. If you gave me a cast of thousands, maybe I could pull it off. So nobody had built that sort of tool. And then suddenly the University of Nevada, Reno Journalism School came by EFF. We had a great meeting and they asked us, can you come up with a research project that you could do with potentially hundreds of journalism students and even like students who are freshmen and sophomores who don't have a lot of experience? And immediately my hand shot up and I'm like, I've got a plan. I have a project that we can do. It's called the Atlas of Surveillance, or at least I came up with that title a little bit later. But the idea was to come up with small research assignments and have a way for a student to spend maybe 20 minutes doing extra credit or doing a homework assignment where we ask them to go look for news articles about body-worn cameras in Albuquerque or to look for face recognition in Seattle. And then once they spend 20 minutes looking for news articles or government documents or press releases, they come back to us and they fill out a form letting us know what they found and summarizing it in a sentence. And so we've done that, you know, for now about 18 months. We collected several thousand data points, but we also started bringing in data points from other data sets. So, for example, Bard College has the Center for the Study of the Drone, and they've been doing great research about what police departments and sheriff's offices have drones. So we just sucked that into our system as well. We grabbed data from, you know, reporters who had done work about face recognition in, say, Florida. We had grabbed stuff, you know, from the Bureau of Justice Assistance and who they'd given body-worn camera grants to. Any place that we could find data about surveillance, we brought it into this. I see you've got the map up here, and this is so great. The map is amazing. It's a little hard to see everything at once because that's just the nature of surveillance technology. So we do encourage people to click on and off the various tabs on the right in that legend, and that'll help you see how things are growing. But really, there in the upper left, you'll see this search the data feature right next to glossary. This to me, it's not as flashy as a map. People love maps, but really, if you were to pop in into that search bar on the left, any city, so you know, maybe put in Chicago or put in, you know, Seattle or something like that, you'll see that it pops up, and that's going to bring this as like a list. You can download this as an Excel file. You can, you know, get all these links. This is also another way to review the information about what's around you.
Wow, I love it. I love the depth of being able to kind of dial in and pull back information. Yes, the map is interesting and fun to kind of interact with, but at the core of this is true, usable, honest information about what's going on. It really gives you a sense of just the scope of this stuff. Now, one thing to point out, though, it's easy to look at this and think like, oh, I'm seeing everything, but that's not necessarily the case, right? Like it's probably next to impossible for you to have access to the knowledge of all of the surveillance that's happening here. Is it like is that primarily like one of the difficult aspects of doing something like this?
Yeah. So you know, depending on what statistics you're looking at, there are somewhere between 18,000 and 20,000 police departments or law enforcement. So let's say 18 to 20,000 law enforcement agencies across the United States. We have some sort of data for about 3,000 of these. So it is like a slim percentage of what's out there. And we don't even have comprehensive data for each of these 3,000. We usually have something. And so this is an ongoing project. This is one where it's going to continue to grow as we have more people collect data and as police acquire more data. One of the other challenges is that communities are getting surveillance thrown out of their police departments. And so we might spend a lot of time putting together a big portion of the data set, only have to remove that data later because it's become obsolete, which is great for people's privacy. It's great for civil liberties. Not so great if you're trying to build a very large, impressive data set. So, for example, in our original version, we had 30 agencies in San Diego County that were using mobile face recognition devices, essentially, you know, souped up phones. By the way, plug on the EFF sticker there. But you would you would use it to take a picture, and then you would use face recognition on the phone. And we had a great map. It illustrated it all, you know, across the entire county of San Diego. Lo and behold, starting January 1st of this year, that form of mobile face recognition technology is illegal. You can't, there's a 3-year moratorium on it. So boom, all of those data points had to come out of our data set. Sad to see them go. Also happy to see the technology no longer in use.
I love the coordination that's involved, just from the outside looking in, of you know, working on this project with the students at the University of Nevada, and knowing that this extends forward. Like, has this become part of like an embedded part of the curriculum there? Is this like an external project outside of classwork, or how does that work?
So as part of our partnership, the University of Nevada, Reno introduced a new course called Cybersecurity, Surveillance, and Society. We also introduced a sort of shorter seminar or semester-long class about the Freedom of Information Act and how to file public records requests. And so those were two core things that are related to the project, but we also integrated this as a project into first and second year media writing classes. So classes where you're just learning the basics on how to write a lead, how to write a summary of a news article. We built that into those classes. So now, you know, a couple of times during the semester, students have to go and spend, you know, 2 or 3 hours doing this. But 2 or 3 hours, maybe they knock out one data point, two data points, three data points. But you scale that over 150 students, that actually is suddenly a large amount of data without draining any individual student. So they're having to spend, you know, 10 hours a day doing this. But it's not just the University of Nevada, Reno. That is our core. Those are the students who are helping us develop it. We have interns who comb through and fact check all the data. We have certain classes like the surveillance class who are doing deeper dives into certain areas like real-time crime centers. But we also have the University of California, Berkeley using it as extra credit for their InfoSec course. We have Kennesaw State University in Georgia using it as extra credit. And we're hoping to see, as this grows in the next semester and the semester after that, having more schools and more students get involved, especially since we're heading into a period where students are going to have to be doing more remote work, and we're going to have to come up with innovative ways for them to gain experience.
Indeed. And I love it. Puts a smile on my face. I love hearing how this all works. So now you've got all this data, you've got to visualize, you've got, you know, immediate access to so many of these data points. It's okay. We'll let you in a second. Has anything surprised you about the finished result, about what you kind of came up with? Any surprises?
Well, I would just say that it's not really finished. We were having to make a decision.
That's true.
About where we were going to go. Do we do it at 5,000? Do we do it, you know, at 10,000? And ultimately, world events told us when we had to go live. We needed to get this out as soon as possible because the world is talking about surveillance. They're talking about policing. It should be out there. Certain things did surprise me. I was surprised to see so much of this technology in rural America. And that's probably one of the biggest benefits of this data set, is that normally when we're looking at surveillance technology, the press is focusing on Chicago and Los Angeles and New York, but they're not focusing on, say, Ogden, Utah. Mountain towns, probably a lot of skiing around there. It's not what you consider like a city where there's a huge gun crime problem. But nevertheless, they've got a camera network there. They have one of these real-time crime centers, which is what's behind me right now. This is just not where I am right now. This is a virtual background, but it's an example of one of these high-tech surveillance centers. And Ogden, Utah has one of these. You're going to find drones and body-worn cameras and license plate readers in the most unlikely of places around the country. And so by having this tool, we're actually able to serve information to a larger number of people across the country, because there are people who are in, you know, middle of Pennsylvania or in Nebraska or Kansas or North Dakota or Wyoming, who aren't seeing the major newspapers really giving them information about this. But they can go to our site, and hopefully we'll have something in their area. And if we don't, they can either add that data to the set themselves, or they can contact us and we'll ask some students to go ahead and dig into it for them.
Love it. So people can get involved. So anyone who wants to check this out, go to atlasofsurveillance.org. That's where you can find the interactive map, all the data points, and the kind of search tools to drill in and everything. And I love what you guys are doing. Dave Mass, EFF.org. Dave, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having a program like this on the air.
Absolutely. And best of luck with your renovations.
Have a good one.
Bye. You too. Take care.
Up next, we cover our stories of the week. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by ExpressVPN. All right. So say you're watching a show and in it there is a giant turtle. And the giant turtle steps over a flow of lava, and somehow it just fine makes it across the flow of lava and goes off into its world. And you look at that, and because you have no suspension of disbelief while you watch shows, you go, that's not possible. So you decide to look up how much heat would it take to burn a turtle's foot. And then you realize, I really don't want people knowing that I'm looking up stuff about how to burn a turtle's foot. Well, that's where ExpressVPN comes in, because you probably think that you can just go in your browser and head to incognito mode or private browsing mode or one of those tools, and then suddenly you think that your activity is hidden. Well, it's not. It doesn't matter what mode you use or how many times you clear your browsing history. Yeah, maybe your partner won't know about you looking up burned turtle feet, but your internet service provider still does. And in fact, they can see every single website you've ever visited. That's why, even when I'm at home, I never go online without using ExpressVPN. It doesn't matter if you get your internet from Verizon or Comcast or Sonic or any of the other ISPs. ISPs in the US can actually legally sell your information to ad companies. ExpressVPN is an app that reroutes your internet connection through its secure servers so your ISP can't see the sites you visit. ExpressVPN also keeps all of your information secure by encrypting 100% of your data with the most powerful encryption available. And in fact, most of the time, I don't even realize that ExpressVPN is turned on because it runs seamlessly in the background and it runs quickly. It's so zippy quick. All you do is tap a button and you're protected. ExpressVPN is available on all your devices. So whether you want to install it on your phones, your computer, heck, it even works with your smart TV if you want it. So there's no excuse for you not to be using it across all of your devices. You can protect your online activity today, even those weird Google searches you're doing, with a VPN rated number one by CNET and Wired. Just head to expressvpn.com/TNW and you're going to get 3 extra months free on a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/TNW. expressvpn.com/TNW to learn more. Our thanks to ExpressVPN for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly and for keeping all of my very strange Google searches private and protected. We do appreciate you.
All right.
To protect the feet, exactly, or the weird searches about the feet. I think this is a really appropriate story, given that we just talked about Twitter at the top of the show. One of the things that Twitter has been criticized for a long time is its treatment of third-party developers and developers who want to make use of Twitter and create apps for Twitter, but who don't have all of the tools available. So it starts with a little bit of a story, because in the beginning, Twitter kind of survived and thrived and was made the tool that it is today because of third-party developers. It's a lot like smartphones in that way, where a smartphone was cool and okay on its own, but really it's all of those apps that we get to take advantage of that sell the experience of those devices. And the same thing was the situation with Twitter. In fact, before the iPhone actually had an app store, someone figured out a way to make apps for the iPhone. And one of those first apps that was ever made was a Twitter app that could be used to, you know, see your tweets as you were going through. So given that, you would think that third-party developers would be kind of treated well and encouraged and, you know, celebrated. But for the longest time, that was not the case. Twitter focused on its own app, and with that came a whole host of new features like polls and new ways that the content was streamed through, and filtering tools, and so many different things, pinned tweets, all these different things that the API could not make use of. The original developer API could not make use of. And so you would have this situation where if you wanted to have the full Twitter experience, you kind of needed to use the Twitter app. And so for the longest time, I have just used Twitter's actual app. But Twitter has announced that despite the issue that it's experienced, it's still going forth with introducing a new and fully rebuilt developer API, and it's coming next week. This is going to be an API version 2, that offers all of the tools to third-party developers, or at least most of the tools that the actual Twitter app itself has, and that it also means that Twitter is going to be able to add new functionality faster than it could in times past. So what's interesting is I think about all of the folks that are in my little kind of tech bubble on the internet who really do like using third-party apps. And you see them on the occasion that they do a poll on Twitter or something like that, they'll say, hey, this is a Twitter poll. You're going to have to either go to twitter.com or you're going to have to launch the Twitter app in order to access this. And there are different things that could and could not, you know, show these Twitter polls, make use of those, and the other tools that Twitter has added over time, including, you know, the new audio tweets that Twitter kind of pulled away from for a while they work on the accessibility side of things. So this is exciting to me. I can remember back when I used to use Tweetbot, and I remember that there was going to be an update to the Twitter API, and Tweetbot announced that if you weren't already sort of logged into to Tweetbot through the Twitter API, you were going to need to do so quickly, because at some point Twitter was going to cap the number of new users who could use the Tweetbot, who could use Tweetbot to access Twitter. And so there was that whole concern. And this, I think, is fantastic because it makes for a better experience for everyone, regardless of what developer app you choose to use, be it Twitter's own or a third-party one. So I'm curious, Jason, do you use the Twitter app on Android, or do you use a third-party app, and why or why not?
I mean, I used to be all about the third-party apps. I used to find my favorite and be dedicated to it until a new one came along, and this one looks better and it does these things that, you know, the original app. And a lot of times the third-party apps seem to just do things better, yes, than the original Twitter app, but also seem to have extra features that you couldn't find in the original Twitter app. But then Twitter did the whole capping that you were talking about, and it really kind of shut things down as far as third-party Twitter app development was developing. It just kind of slowed it down. If you weren't one of the lucky ones to get in early on that particular app, then you were kind of out of luck for the most part. So I switched over to the primary, official Twitter app, and I've been using that for a few years now, and it's been fine. I've totally gotten used to it, and I think I give Twitter a lot of credit. I think they've made some really great improvements to it to make it usable, and I don't really find myself longing for many things outside of what it provides, but I am still sad for the developers who helped create Twitter, that their efforts and their third-party development really helped create the power of Twitter, and then the rug was just kind of pulled out from underneath them. So I'm happy to see that there's thought and there's development on the back end, as far as these APIs are concerned, bringing some of these features to the API so that some of these third-party developers can kind of cash in a little bit on some of these extra features. But if there's still that cap there, it's kind of but that's still limiting developers in a way that's really, I don't know, it's really restrictive. And I wonder if there's going to ever be a change in the opposite direction again in that regard.
And it goes back to, Twitter trying to be a profitable company.
Sure.
And how that may or may not be hurt by having these third-party apps that don't have the ads pulled in as well. So I don't know. It's tough right now. It's especially, and again, tough. It's a relative term. There's way more that's way more tough right now. But in this very specific instance, it's tough that I'm running the iOS 14 beta and for the sake of the job that I do, and the Twitter app itself is just utterly broken in this version of iOS, and it's not It's not so broken that I can't read text, but everything else, the links and articles and images and all that stuff, it doesn't show up. And you have to force quit the app in order to get them to show up. It's very strange, and I don't know, you know, what is causing it, but obviously it's the beta. And so I ended up re-downloading Tweetbot to see if I could use that temporarily. And it's just, it would take so much work to go back to that, given my how I am so used to using just the Twitter app itself. So totally. I'm just using the Twitter app, and I just don't see as many links and things, which probably is better for my mental health anyway. So it ends up being a good thing in the end.
I'd agree with that. Yeah, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, so I'll have to keep an eye on this for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. I think it's good news. I'm happy to see Twitter being a little bit more open with what they're bringing to developers. I just think there's that one big hurdle that's still going to, you know, always have me going, yeah, but, you know. My story of the week is about escape rooms. Are you a fan of escape rooms, Micah? Have you ever done one?
I've never actually gotten to do one. I was planning on it, and then all of this happened, and so I haven't gotten to. But they always seem exciting. I would love to do one.
Yeah, there are a lot of different facets of the world that are shut down because of the coronavirus. Escape room is definitely one of them. You're not going to find an escape room that you can do very easily or safely. Well, what are librarians who create escape rooms to do when the pandemic closes libraries? Which, first of all, I didn't know that librarians did this. I didn't know that there were librarians that created escape rooms in libraries. So that's news to me. I love it. Secondly, those librarians apparently take their escape room dreams to Google Forms. I came across an article on The Verge that was all about this, that apparently in this shutdown, you know, libraries are closed in so many different places, definitely here in Petaluma, and have been for months. So librarians are looking for ways to kind of keep kids and students and really anyone who wants to learn engaged and active with what you can find in libraries and everything. And so there are librarians creating like virtual digital escape rooms using Google Forms. And this article on The Verge links to a number of them. There's like one for Harry Potter. There's one for Star Wars. There's space themed ones. There's all different types, but you step through the form pages and kind of read the story and the clues as if you were in some sort of an escape room. So it's almost like you take Zork or an old text-based adventure game, and then you combine it with an escape room and some pictures and a librarian kind of guiding the educational experience. And then you end up in a room and you have to choose from multiple choice based on some of the clues that you've been given along the way. And, you know, hopefully you get it right and then you can continue on through the escape room. I just thought it was a really clever way of kind of bringing escape rooms to the digital age, but also like doing this through Google Forms, which whoever would have thought that you could make something this fun through Google Forms. I just think it's a really cool idea.
That's awesome. And so can anyone go and do this?
Oh, yeah. So there's a bunch of them listed in the article. I don't know how you find them outside of this article. I may have missed that inside of the article, but they link the author, Alaya Chaudhry, links to a number of them in there. So you can find a few. And like, I'm going to jot them down. And, you know, our girls are starting back to school this week and next week. So this could be a nice little, you know, filler way to kind of fill time in between regular curriculum work and stuff to give them something fun to do. But it's kind of neat. I had no idea. And then I came across this article. I was like, wow, no kidding. People are really resourceful and creative.
It's so inspiring to see that. Yeah. And I think that's important too, that we see, you know, people continuing to triumph where they can and when they can. So this is cool.
Absolutely. So check that out. And we're happy you checked out this episode of Tech News Weekly. We have reached the end of this show. We publish this show every Thursday. So you can go to twit.tv/TNW. There you can subscribe to the show in audio and video formats. Select your favorite podcatcher, link out to YouTube and subscribe there. We try to make it easy for you to subscribe so that you don't miss a single episode of Tech News Weekly.
Yes. You can, of course, be a part of the show if you'd like by emailing us. It's tnw@twit.tv. And go ahead and follow us on social media. It's at twit on Twitter. It's at twit.tv on Instagram. It's at twit talk on TikTok. I was just on there today watching how to make a traditional chai, which was really kind of fun.
I just saw that too.
Yeah. So you can head there. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Micah Sargent on pretty much all of the social media networks, actually. So following me on those is easy. And of course, check out Hands on iOS. It's twit.tv/HOI to check out Hands on iOS, where I cover all sorts of stuff related to your iOS devices, teaching you how to make use of the tools that are available. And the episode that will be coming out later today talks about using Safari and how to use reader mode and get the most out of your Safari browsing experience, because most people who are using their iPhones are probably using the Safari browser. So there's some tips and tricks you might want to check out there. What about you, Jason?
Nice. I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. My other show to plug here is Hands on Android, twit.tv/HOA. New episode went up this morning. It's all about backing up your device. Say you're getting ready to clear out, you know, factory reset your device or whatever. I've gone through the situation where I think I backed everything up and then I reset my device. And then I remember, oh no, there was that app that had the thing in it and it didn't back up and now it's gone forever. And I don't like that feeling. So I recorded an episode all about like the different things that you can check before you wipe your device, how cloud backup works on Android and all that stuff. So check it out, twit.tv/HOA. A for Hands on Android, and learn a thing or two about how cloud backup works on your Android device. Thanks to everyone who helps us do this show each and every week. Of course, John back at the studio, he also helps us with our hands-on shows, so thank you for that. Whole lot of thank yous going around. Also thanks to Burke, who's in the studio, and thanks to you for watching and listening each and every week. We'll see you next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Check out other shows here on Twit TV, including my show, Hands-On Photography. On this show, I'm going to show you how to get the most out of your camera, as well as be a better post-processor. So head on over to twit.tv/hop and subscribe now.